Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economic. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pools in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. Even though you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
Thank you. Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
But you say, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again, this time on the near side, for another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
What is attention fabric building? You've probably driven by or been inside one without even knowing. More than they appear, fabric structures are highly engineered buildings that offer numerous cost and mobility benefits over their more traditional counterparts. Everything from livestock facilities to commercial storage structures utilize the versatile nature of tension fabric buildings.
A tension fabric structure is a fabric membrane stretched over top of steel trusses. It's engineered to withstand wind load and snow load and keeps all the assets safe. We have a lot of buildings in the agriculture industry, a lot of corporate farmers. Cattle confinement are quite often used for our building. We have a lot of industry in the commercial business as well, a lot of commodity storage for salt and sand. We go into the aviation industry quite a bit because of our clear spanning design. We can fit in large aircrafts with very low maintenance. We also do a lot of work with the military and government sectors to provide temporary housing for disaster relief. And we have a lot of stuff in the oil and gas and mining industries to do equipment storage.
Beyond being a more economical choice over conventional steel buildings, tension fabric structures cost less to operate, save energy, have natural lighting, are quickly installed or relocated, provide flexible foundation design options, and have exceptional corrosive resistance, all while falling under the same requirements, codes, and certification of any other steel building.
So some of the main types of structures we work with in agricultural cattle confinement, we've done some dairy barns, done a lot of riding arenas, we've done a lot of grain storage buildings, we've done a lot of buildings for people to store their toys in, whether it's their race cars or sports cars or whatever it happens to be, anything that's important to somebody, try and design a building around that.
The fabric structure industry is burgeoning, so some misconceptions still exist, particularly when it comes to lifespan. However, quality raw materials, combined with exceptional workmanship, can make for superior products that will last for many years. In the future, tension fabric buildings will become an even more popular option for human occupancy and large commercial facilities. Experts contend that tension fabric buildings should be considered for any building solution.
The fabric buildings, I feel, are brighter, they ventilate better, the cow's comfort seems to be better in here. I don't feel they're any more expensive than the steel buildings, and I think that in the maintenance over the next 20 years, there may be less with one of these buildings than there will be with the steel.
Winkler Structures is recognized for the highest quality, innovative products, and the best level of service in the fabric structure industry. Not only innovative, but also experienced, Winkler has designed and manufactured over 15 million square feet of fabric structures since their inception in 1978. Winkler Structures goes above and beyond what is required in their relationships, products, and tasks.
Winkler Canvas is basically a custom manufacturer. We like to listen to the customer's needs and design products around what they require. We have a large line of products, but usually modify them to kind of meet the customer's requirements or needs.
The advantages to the Winkler fabric structures is the wide open concepts allow for easy layouts to the facilities. The natural lighting allows for better energy costs all around for the farmer and savings. And the open concept allows for better ventilation, which is a healthier environment for the animal.
In the beginning, Winkler Structures just wanted to build solutions no one else was building, and to this day operates transparently, honestly, and fairly while providing the best service and product in the industry.
Our buildings have a unique advantage of being lightweight and being able to set up very easily, so we can send multiple structures to remote areas and have local people set them up without having to have full construction crews. Some buildings large like this do require full construction crews, but we have residential units that are very simple to put together.
Yeah, almost every order, the customer calls in, says they like our product, but they're wondering if we could change a little bit to meet their requirements. So there's very few orders, actually, that are straight out of the price book. Almost all of them require some design time to meet what the customer is looking for.
We've been in this fabric building for a little over a year. The cows seem to be doing well. The cows are happy back here. Our production is up 10 to 12 pounds. We feel the cows are healthier overall. The breeding, everything is better back here. We can work smarter instead of harder.
Winkler Structures has the no-compromise fabric structure that will suit your needs. For more information, please visit www.winklerstructures.com or call toll-free at 1-800-852-2638.
You often see tension fabric buildings on farms or at public works yards, storing equipment and bulk materials like gravel or road salt. Tension fabric buildings can also house small factories, like this one, which manufactures these buildings. The fabric cover is high-density polyethylene, a material known for its exceptional strength when subjected to tension. It withstands strong winds and heavy snow accumulation. Following the engineer's plan, workers cut the required number of sheets of a specific length. Then the assembly process begins. They flatten and tape down the first sheet to immobilize it, then overlap the adjacent sheet by 5 centimeters. They tape down that sheet to keep it in position. With a hot air welder, they seam the sheets. The welder slightly melts the overlapping edges with hot air, then presses them together with heavy wheels. This fuses the edges into a sturdy seam. Workers use the same process to weld on tension pockets 60 centimeters in from the bottom and sides. Each pocket will contain a steel or PVC tube holding nylon straps spaced 60 to 300 centimeters apart, depending on the building size. These straps apply tension to fasten the fabric down over the steel structure. The assembled sheets form a single cover that forms the sides and roof of the building. Separate covers form the front and back walls. The covers of the largest buildings are made differently. Workers connect multiple covers with what's known as a Keter system. Keter is ultra-strong PVC or nylon rope.
I tell you my total Etsy income, one woman and a sewing machine.
No.
Okay, take a guess. I've been doing it since 2008, so just a random guess. How much?
90,000? No, more than that.
It is a little higher.
Oh, 350?
A little higher.
300?
It's less than 300. A $250,000.
Right.
One woman and a sewing machine. I started in 2006. I was a stay-at-home mom. We had three children at the time. And I was like president of PTA. My husband was a captain of an Airbus. It was a good life. Until a letter came in the mail to let me know, and my husband know, that the airline that he had worked for 20 years was filing bankruptcy, and he would be unemployed. So, this is my husband on the couch. I don't know if you've ever lost your identity, but it's no fun. And I think women do better with that than men. It's especially no fun for men. He was my husband Dylan on the couch, and he stayed there for quite some time. And both of our dreams, in a sense, were flushed down the toilet because all I ever wanted to be was a mom. So I didn't want to have to leave these kids and put them in daycare. And I also was holding out a little bit of hope that he would fly again, and that would mean traveling, and so it was kind of pointless for me to go and get a full-time job, and then what do I do with these children, right? Mm-hmm. So I sat and spent 3 days about, because it's pure panic. You go from a nice income to no income. You've got to do something. What can I do? What can I do? I went to that life is good mentality, and I thought, if we have to redesign our whole life, we're going to do something that we love. So Darren couldn't even talk about love. He's still on the couch. So I said, what do I love? I know I love babies, and I know I love bags. I still really love bags, and then I'm kind of looking for a grandbaby.
You grandma,
right?
Right?
Their 13th birthday. So this is in 2006. So the wave hadn't hit yet with handmade goods. So I thought, I'll buy other people's goods and resell them on my .com. And I thought, that's a good idea. I can do that and stay at home with the kids. And so the product started arriving. Most of it I was getting off eBay. And I could see like little tiny flaws and imperfections. I had ideas. Oh, if they would have just done this, it'd be so much better. That probably happens to y'all when you're working. And so I just couldn't help myself, and I went and bought a sewing machine, which puts me down here at the novice level. This is the person who borrows the machine and then asks you to thread it for them. You have to laugh. They're going to get real far since the bottom runs out, right? It's like, what do I do with it now? And they're knocking at your door. Can you find this bobbin for me? Yeah. So I got a sewing machine. I'm sitting at our dining room table, which is right inside of our front door. And it wasn't very long. You know how the fabric addiction works. Pretty fast. And there's no stopping it. Have any of you recovered?
No.
Yeah. So I have pictures of our youngest daughter, Isabel, who's now 9, as an infant, in a pile of remnants this high. I have a problem. So I fill our dining room with fabric, and I have a sewing machine, And I'm learning slowly how to sew and not scream at people when they interrupt me. I make it through that phase of the business. And I have a product that's very basic, but my friends and neighbors will buy it probably because they feel really bad on me. Darren is still on the couch. So I take these bags to the high school and have a craft fair, and I sell $500, which I was like, wow, this is fun. I like having my own money. And we can eat this week, honey. I then had a little better product, and I took that to eBay, because there actually was a really nice handmade division of eBay back in 2006. And I did very well on eBay. I made power seller status and was consistently earning at least $500 a month, which is buying up groceries, and some food is better than no food. So then in 2008, one of my eBay customers told me about Etsy. And for me, Etsy really was an overnight success. I had a sale in just a few hours, and sales were consistent. They were way better than eBay because I have this very targeted customer base. When you go to Etsy, you're looking for handmade. When you go to eBay, you could be looking for anything, right? So I was had that instant success. So Darren had a job again, another airline. We decided we should have a fourth kid. I was having a great time running my little business. We had some extra money. Guess what happened? He lost his second airline job. And I'm super pregnant. And that was before we had any health care laws to protect us. So now we don't have a job. We have a baby on the way. And we have no health insurance. That was terrifying. Luckily, I had fairly decent rent, but it was street-level boutique. So what I didn't know was when you own a boutique, you don't have customers coming in all year, especially in a town like Middleburg. It's very seasonal. When the weather's good, you go walk around Middleburg. You don't walk around Middleburg in the winter. So I had this lease, and I had to now sew as hard as I was sewing before, fill all my Etsy orders and pay this rent and fill the store. That's the part I underestimated. How am I going to fill this store up? I don't have time to make all this product. And what happens if you go in a store and there's not much to look at, right? And I'm taking it serious. So I had to get other people to make things and bring them into my store. And luckily people were excited to do that because they too loved Middleburg. And a lot of people would come into the shop and ask me, oh, I want to do what you do, how can I do it? And I said, you can sell your stuff right here. I don't have time to fill the store. So I gave them a really good deal. It was like a 60-40 split in their favor. But what I didn't realize was when they would start collaborating, there was like this energy, this amazing, I call it like a high, or they might say in the zone, and time would cease for me, and I was so happy to just be networking with them. And I knew then that's the good stuff. How do I get more of that? But I never could figure out how to balance those winter months and the high rent and all of that so it would make financial sense to keep that boutique open. But I wanted to find a way to keep those beautiful people in my life. So I made the hard decision. I closed that store. And it was a hard goodbye, but I said goodbye to everybody. A lot of people were sad, but it just wasn't going to make financial sense to do that. So I don't look at that as a failure. I say I earned my MBA. I spent that much money. And I probably learned more than it would teach you if I had gone to school. So right before I closed that shop, I founded SewAspire.com, which is a YouTube channel. And initially I thought, I want to reach 10,000 people. And that was just an outrageous number that I just picked to throw out there. I have one subscriber, guess who it was? No. My husband. I told the kids, I'm going to be a YouTuber. They're teenagers, so they're like, okay, Mom. So I bought a GoPro. I didn't know what I was doing. I really didn't. My first videos, I don't have the heart to delete them because they're proof of what a dork I was. So I keep them out there anyway. And sometimes people will watch them and they have their nerve to go, oh, you ought to do this. There's 100 more videos after that. Fast forward. So I did that, and I started with that one loyal fan that I have, and closed the shop, and then I moved into a little tiny, probably, what do you think that space was, like less than 200 square feet, tiny one-room commercial space in the Plains, Virginia, which is just a little bit up the road from Middleburg. And I really, at that point, was still kind of licking my wounds from the shop and just wanted to figure out who I was going to be and how I was getting there. So there was one window in the place, and it faced another building, and there was a vine at the side of the building. So by summertime, I had no light. One rinky-dink light at the top. And so I stayed there, and my focus was growing that YouTube channel. And I would consistently produce free tutorials for them once a week, and then growing my Etsy business. Now, at this time, I didn't have any more babies and diapers, so I didn't really carry a diaper bag anymore, so I was finding it harder to communicate with new moms. I did have with a camera and four beautiful children, so I had grown very fond of photography. And so I adapted that product line to the camera bag, which I brought some samples to show you. My scrappy patchwork camera bag. And this, the padding on this, believe it or not, is baby crib, the new foams were baby crib bags. So my mom was still thinking for my camera, we're going to keep shoes I couldn't shave. So I started making camera bags and then camera strap covers, because you know how the camera strap is so irritating on the neck, and then there's a little pocket there for the lens cap. I invested in embroidery machine. Does anybody have an embroidery machine? They're a lot of fun too. Thread addiction, right after fabric addiction.
Right.
Yeah. So that's what I do now in my Etsy shop, is make custom camera bags and camera strap covers. And then the Etsy shop's always been great, so I had no problem building up that. And I'm slowly growing this YouTube channel. And now we're up to almost 25,000 subscribers when I turn that focus on to that. So because I had so much extra time running these two businesses, just kidding, I launched another business called TheFourScene.com, because I was still not getting my fix with these women that I miss so much. So TheFourScene, I just launched last October, and it's a platform to mentor and coach other women who think they're just moms or just sewers, and they want to break into the Etsy world or any form or fashion of selling your products. So I launched that, and that's the facet of my business that I'm most excited about, because I want to get back there working with those women and those makers again, because it's exactly the feeling I had here when I saw what you all are doing. This stuff does change the world. It's not just sewing or just quilting. And you all know that, so I'm preaching to the choir. But when you're passionate about something like that, you'll do anything to get back there and have more of that. So what I did in May, because now this little studio is closing in on me, and that vine's growing like crazy, and I have no light, and I want to do all these things, I moved into my dream studio. It's on the third floor of the same building, 500 square feet. I have a back office. I have so much sunlight. It's unbelievable. And if you go to the YouTube channel, there's a tour of it, so you can see it. All my fabric bits. 20 sewing machines fixed. I need that many, right? My husband, God bless him, he never asked any questions. Okay, honey. I just keep loading it in. So that's what I'm doing now, and we've set some big goals for the YouTube channel. Actually, my 9-year-old set this goal. I woke up one Saturday morning to her going, Mom, do you realize you can get this plaque from YouTube when you reach 100,000 subscribers? I'm like, oh, really? It's about that size. She keeps talking about. So I looked it up. It's a legit thing. They'll send you this plaque. And she was so excited about it. And I said, okay, so we probably can't get to 100,000 subscribers, because I made it this far. I'm like, what, 25% of the way there? I said, all right, what do you want to do when we get 100,000 subscribers? And we decided we're going to go in a hot air balloon. So then, because my children are overachievers, I don't know how that happened. I can't imagine where we went wrong. Your dad was on the couch. They look at me and they go, Mom, what are you going to do when you get to 1 million subscribers? Okay, we're going to ride elephants in India. Is that good enough? So that's my story, but I want to leave you with a quote, my favorite quote, and a thought, so in case you don't get everything else I said tonight. So the quote, forever, I thought, was by someone named George Eliot, and I have a silver bookmark there. My husband found it on an airplane more than a decade ago, because you know when they clean the airplanes, people leave stuff behind. And he found that, and he thought it reminded him of me. He brought it home to me. He had no idea. I asked him about it the other day. He had no idea I still have it. And I read it every day when I go to work. And it says, it is never too late to be what you might have been. George Eliot. I'm assuming George is a man. All these years. But I knew I was coming here and I was using this quote, so I said, better Google George to make sure he's not a freak. I'm going to quote him. George is a woman. That was her pen name. And she was a very famous Victorian age author who wanted her work to be respected. And she used a man's name. That was in the 1800s. So, and her real name is Marianne Evans. So if Marianne knew that to be the truth in the 1800s, we can believe it today in 2018. So it's never too late. That's the first thought. And then the second thought slash lesson is you must have more than one dream in this lifetime. Okay? It's all right to have more than one dream and chase it. And you are the only person that has to believe in your dream. Okay?
Welcome.
Gentlemen, Jim. Who is that coming?
Jim, here, let me.
It's the dressmaker. Who are you?
Just abruptly interrupting. Are we really starting here?
Yeah.
Ooh, this is Candid. It's our bloopers this morning. Hi, everybody. Victoria Baylor, dressmaker.
Thank you for being here with me.
Well, thank you for having
me. I thought I was
me.
Going to be here by myself.
Oh, my God.
I didn't want to cry.
Mr. Jim has been busy working in his workshop, just turning
it's a
out
mess
jackets.
Too.
Have you you guys been following along with him on, of course, you're on Instagram?
Instagram, Facebook.
Facebook. He's posting in all the major sewing groups.
Mm-hmm.
You should be seeing, like, a new jacket and suit every day.
Mm-hmm.
That's what Mr. Joe's doing. So, anyway, welcome to our show. We know it's been a little time lapse. Things have been a little bit crazy in our world.
Yeah, it has.
But,
yeah.
You know, we love to reconnect with you guys. So, we're going to start this show actually by just answering a question that I received recently,
yeah.
Mr. Jim and I.
Yeah.
And we'll kind of talk about it because we like to think about the full scope of answering questions with you. So, here is our question. And our question comes from the fabulous Golden Seal. Mrs. Seal, Miss Golden. I hope you don't mind that I said your name. She's a wonderful viewer of ours. And her question is, she said, first of all, she wants to say she's an avid watcher. Thank you, Golden. We appreciate you watching us and the follower. But her question is, I am starting a sewing business from home myself, and my husband found a client for me. The only thing is the client lives in Ohio, and she lives in New York.
New York City.
That's right. So they're kind of, yeah, they're good. Is Ohio, how far is it? I'm geographically challenged. That's a good bit of distance, right?
Yeah.
Okay, that's right. That's like Midwest.
It's in the Central.
Ohio. Yeah. And then, of course, the mm-hmm. East Coast is New York. So her question is it possible to have a long-distance business with clients away from your hometown? And if so, how do you make it work? And then her idea, she says, because I would think fitting would be an issue. But my husband feels like I can do it, but I'm not sure. Shout out to our husbands for the vote of confidence.
Shout
That's very
out.
Sweet. You must have some really great abilities.
Yeah.
You got your hubby behind you. And then she just asked, what can you share with me about this? She's asking our opinion. How do you deal with, can you really sew for clients that are in your hometown?
Well,
what are your thoughts
I do
sir?
It quite a bit. And a lot of you guys, I know you guys do it because nobody's at your doorstep. Okay. The key issue is to get precise, exact measurements. It's all about measurements. Now, how do you do that? Well, for one, you need good body measurements. That's number one. Secondly, what I always tell people, and it depends on what you're making again,
mm-hmm.
is what are you making? Okay? Because if it's, for argument's sake, a pair of pants, a pair of slacks for whoever, you need the waist and the seat are the most important measurements
mm-hmm.
on that. Then you need a length. Then you need how wide is the leg going to be. Best way to do that is to have them measure something that they like the fit, not just measure any old thing.
And even with that being said, I oftentimes have my clients just bring a pair of pants.
Yeah, they can bring
like something they have that were, and it's a good kind of reference. I
yeah,
totally agree
yeah.
with you. Yeah.
I have a client who's is another city. And what he does is, I've been doing some, this has just been an alteration, but he'll send me a pair of pants the way he likes to fit, because he lost a lot of weight, and I just duplicate him.
Very helpful.
See?
So I think, so what, and Mr. Jim and I like to, we always like to play good cop, bad cop with situations. So this is a very, it's a very good question for one, and it's a very, to some degree, it can be a complex answer, just depending upon what you sew, like what Mr. Jim said. So if you're working and doing things that are unfitted, like we have a friend we know that makes gorgeous, loosely fitted jackets, anybody can buy those because it's not really relegated on a specific number. You have 5, 6, 7, 8 inches of ease, perfect. A lot of people fit in that.
Yeah.
But the closer something fits to someone, that's when it sometimes can get a little tricky, especially when you're working with non-knits.
Yeah.
So it really comes down, just like Mr. Jim says, at least kind of the way I think about it, measurements, let's see, client body measurements, type of garment, and I had a couple other notes, fabric type, and then it really boils down to the comfort of the individual that's sewing it. So like for me specifically, I have a rule. I don't sew a ton of fitted stuff for people that I can't fit personally. I'm a hands-on, technical, like to touch my client's feet kind of person. But I do make dresses and stuff like that I can ship that are more, you know, loose and fit a variety of body measurements. So I do, yes.
There's some notes that you could do also is have them take a picture of themselves.
Yeah.
Picture always is a very good thing because you see the sculpture of their body.
Yep.
Whereas you're guessing at it because they could be short-waisted.
Yep.
Long-waisted.
Mm-hmm.
They could have a lot here and less there.
Absolutely.
Right? So with a picture, you can kind of see these things. And it, like I say, it depends on your comfort level. And because you're starting a business at home and your husband was kind enough to get you this long-distance client, tell them to work on the locals where you can find them.
That's true, too. And he's absolutely right. So there's the answer, like in general, there's no surefire way. You want to just use your best, wisest judgment. Mm-hmm. And sometimes when you're starting out, you know, you do want to be careful not to be too ambitious and take on stuff that you don't feel comfortable. And then one way to just kind of dip your toe in the water is grab a friend, make something for
there
them that is local. Fit, so we've discussed in previous things, Mr. Jim and I, in complete agreement. Sewing is comprised of, or making garments from, there's the sewing aspect, there's the fitting aspect. You have to become an aficionado, like both of them. You have to be really good and fit. Sometimes ends up being the trickiest part, even out the sewing.
That's right.
Because sewing's more mechanical. Fit takes a little bit of knowledge, experience. You're totally right. I look at people and I see posture.
Sure.
Like, how do they slant sideways? Mm-hmm. Some people have high rears. Some people are low in the front. Mm-hmm. Like, they're not all straight. And when you were talking about arms, are they meatier up here in the bicep?
That's right.
They might need a little bit more space. Mm-hmm. So maybe there's a way of using videos to kind of get around that or some other stuff. But you want to just be wise. You're totally right. Because there's a lot involved in fitting. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Really, really great question, Golden. We appreciate you for asking.
You know.
No, you got anything?
And basically, make sure your craft
is
sufficient.
This is just like, do it right.
You bet.
You, Golden, but just like everybody in general.
Your craft has to be sufficient.
That's right.
Because when people are spending their money, they want a good product. They really do.
Yeah.
Because that's how the business grows, through word of mouth.
Yeah.
Not always who comes to you, because people refer and they refer when they refer. So with that said, hone your craft real well.
And I'm not going to lie, I've been sewing for, I think, at least for professionally with clients for maybe 15 or so years. And when I first started, it had to be the most nerve-wracking thing to start because you are dealing with different body types and different types of garments. I don't know, Golden, if you're going to sell just one type, it might be super easy to do it. But like with mine, with fluctuating with formal wear, I mean, it went from very fitted to different. It just got a little nerve-wracking. But project by project, like Mr. Jim says, make sure that the craftsmanship is impeccable and always create fail safe. So let me interject this. I'm a muslin girl when it comes to sewing with clients. Even if I don't sew one for myself, I always create something so that my clients can kind of get a visual of what it looks like and they can kind of get a sense of the fit and I can make any adjustments to the final. So for me, it helps to serve as a barrier and kind of as a way of helping them see where things are going and then helping us as a guardrail against any issues. So maybe that might be it. I've seen people send Muslims in the mail. They're like, try this on. Let me see you by video.
Yeah, a lot of people do
try
that.
It on. This and that looks great. I'll send you the final. So there's a middle line way of doing it.
As you guys know, I had been asked through the years, what about my sewing? And one time I had several lines out through the years. And
these are lines of clothing, right?
This is a line of clothing that I did when I had a boutique.
Okay.
And I do everything one of a kind, and I found that the way I do my things, they're one of a kind. So it puts that whoever purchases my garment in a very special place because nobody else will have it. You know, when you buy something retail, if you don't make it yourself, they've made multiples of them. And women look at women.
Yes, they
do. Okay. So I started a line of my classic look. It's called Classic Is Forever Classic. And you know, I've been posting and showing bits and pieces. A lot of people have been wanting to buy it, and I tell them, hold on, it's for the fall. See? And I finished a piece yesterday, and I want to show you guys what I do. You know, who maybe you hadn't looked online to see what I do, but this is my latest piece.
And if you missed it, please go sign up for his Instagram, because Mr. Jim is putting some fabulous stuff out. It looks really, really good. He made this for me. He just doesn't know it yet. No,
I sure did. But this is my last piece. And this is one of the other keys, because people say in how you match everything up. It should be.
It's pretty.
This
gorgeous
pattern is very busy. Very busy. So you have to match it up to where it looks what it is.
That is pretty amazing, especially with this. Is it? And it's floral. It's kind of neat. It has this whole, I like this motif.
Mm-hmm.
It's gorgeous, the colors and everything. And
let
that black background.
This fits you.
Does it fit me? I'm a little short-waisted, narrow shoulder gal. If we're out of camera focus, we're sorry. We're standing. All right, and I'll bend down and see if it does. Now, I do have gorilla-like arms, so they're super long. Ooh, that's fancy. Fancy jacket. Y'all see me? Have a look on me.
Mm-hmm.
It's all cute and black. Oh, nice. I love that black. Mr. Jim, you're going to make me start sewing some jackets. It's nice. And then look at that. The wow factor, the pop of that lining color. Very nice. And it feels so good and substantial.
Mm-hmm. The reason why I want to show this is because I saw a post on Facebook, and I tagged it because a lady did something out of upholstery and drapery factory.
Mm-hmm.
And people say, wow, I didn't know you could do that. And people say, yeah, I use it all the time. That's what I use.
Yeah,
this is upholstery fabric. Actually, this one is drapery fabric there. I use this a lot because you get a different look.
Yeah, it feels great.
You get a different look. It's not always heavy. You can get it in different weights and this, that, and the other.
It's actually really soft.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
very, very soft.
And you find, when you make things out of like this, you'll never find them in industry. Because
mm-hmm.
they're not going through these changes.
That's true.
See?
That's true.
So consider that, you sewers out there. Check out upholstery, drapery fabrics. And let me tell you a good place to find some very unique places. Go to a Goodwill or that type of place.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's always somebody who donated a panel.
Oh, that's true, yeah. And yeah, that's a lot of fabric.
Or it's got a little stain somewhere, but that's a big piece of drapery fabric. You might buy it for $2 or $3.
Because you said you made this out of scraps, right?
Yeah, I made this out of leftovers.
Very nice.
Okay.
Very nice. Oh, and then just one thing. I'm going to do a shameless plug because I never usually do shameless plugs. Since we were kind of talking about having a sewing business and kind of getting everything straightened out with that, for those that don't know, I did do a course. Yes, I did it a while back ago. It's on how to do sewing consults successfully, and it's geared toward not just doing the consult. So the consult is where it starts with the client. If you have a sewing business, you have to have your processes and everything in order to ensure that, you know, everything goes well.
Yeah.
It's not just about making the garment, it's also the business doing part.
Right.
So I created a really in-depth course. I think it's over like 3.5 hours, something like that. It deals with everything from all the proper paperwork to have, from creating a good business policy, the different personality types you may encounter, and how to interact with those. Because a lot of what we do dealing with the public is personality driven. So you have to know how to kind of like navigate that, how to conduct phone calls, answer questions, create disclaimers. Like, it's really in depth, and someone bought it recently and they like sang praises. So sometimes I don't promote enough, but if it's a resource that can help you guys, I want to put it out there. So I will include a link. Please check it out. It's only $29, but it will be well worth that.
Yeah.
It's weight in gold. So, and then come get Mr. Jim, when do these go live? When are you selling?
In fall.
Okay.
It'll be late September, early October.
And these are one of a kind, so keep an eye out.
And they will be signed.
Oh, are we doing like
I'm
the
signing
inside prop liners?
Each one. So if Picasso can do it, Gentleman Jim can.
It's a one of a kind.
It's
it
a one
is.
Of a kind.
So make sure you be on the lookout for that too. We'll be getting his website up. But
okay.
Anyway, we love you guys.
See you guys later.
Take care. Bye. Yeah.
Working environment spaces like this, you have to be really careful. Every time you handle the machine, threading it, whatever you're doing, you have to, health and safety reason, you have to switch your machine off. Cutting, no fabric, no cotton on the floor, because it's dangerous. You can step on it and slide and fall and hurt yourself. So therefore, that is really important. Needles, pins, nothing like that. You shouldn't throw them on the floor. Every tool you use, all the tools, it has to go back. Mustn't leave scissors, a snip, a screwdriver, anything laying around. Everything you use, everything for put back. That's the most important thing to work safely in this sort of environment. The standard problems are, if there's cottons or fabric on the floor, you can step and slide and then you fell and you hurt yourself. And while you're threading the machine, if you don't switch the machine off, machine is quite fast. By accident, if you can press the pedal, and then you can, while your hand's under the machine, you can hurt your needle goes through your finger, and then you can hurt yourself. And then the same is the scissors. If you hold on scissors, it snip. You're walking around in the place, you can accidentally, you can injure someone. So therefore, that is sort of thing that we must avoid. So always you put the tools away, and when you walk around, make sure that you don't carry no scissors, nothing in your hand. So now I cut all my samples I'm going to make. Now I'm going to do 10 stitches using my foot as a guide, parallel to one another. I'm going to do 10 stitch. This is my 10 stitch. Now I'm going to do slow curve. doing two straight line. There's my two pieces of fabric. I'm going to put them together, make a seam. This is straight hem. Needle seams I'm going to do. This is a strap, double needle a strap. Now we adjust into tension, you stitch it, and then you stitch it too loose, so therefore I'm tightening the tension. The first stitch before adjust the tension, second stitch after adjust the tension. That's the wrong stitch, that's the right stitch. Now we cut all shapes, both wave, circle, hard and straight. And then two pieces of fabric, putting it together and overlock it. Now we're doing demonstrating how to put them together, how to do the shapes and two pieces together. This is two pieces together. Wavy edges. Straight line. Mm-hmm. There's a heart shape. Circle.